welcome to Consumer Choice Radio on the 28th of March in the year 2020. We are broadcasting on the Big Talker 106.7 FM out of Wilmington, North Carolina. We're live every Saturday at 10 in the morning. Our website is consumerchoiceradio.com. There you can listen to past episodes. You can read all the show notes and articles, videos, and such that we mention. You can also follow us on social media there and find all of our links. And I'm joined, as always, I'm Yael Lasoski, one of your co-hosts, and I'm joined by Mr. David Clement, coming to us not far away. Sir David, yep. Welcome, sir.
Yep, yeah, another week, another show. We're staying inside like a pair of house cats, feeling a little claustrophobic, but managing to keep things together amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. Seems to be the ongoing theme every week. It's hard not to talk about it because it's front and center in terms of defining what everybody can do. But yeah, here we are.
And if you want your hot take of the day, you can follow David on Twitter at Clement Liberty. And I am at Yaelossos, Yaelossos. And we had plenty to talk about, and we definitely got our social media knives sharpened this week. There was plenty to cover. I mean, goodness me, there's much happening. And I think it's, we might as well start with a couple of clips. Let's get right into it. This is what we need. Let's figure this out. What would you like to hear first, Sir David? Here, I'll put it up to you. This is a democracy on this program. What would you like to hear first?
Let's go with everybody's friend, and I say this sarcastically, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Okay, that's a good one. Here we go.
It's great to see you.
We'll make it work.
Yeah, we're going to try to make it work. So the testing thing, I think, is really, maybe I'm a bit obsessed with it, because at this point, it seems insane in a modern country.
This is Joy Reid, by the way, on MSNBC, who is likely one of the worst reporters out there. A liar, someone who has been caught lying about her stance on LGBT issues in the past, and generally a very bad reporter.
A great city like New York City, that it seems almost impossible for people to get a test. Can a New Yorker or someone in this city that is symptomatic in some way get a test if they need it, and if so, how?
Joy, there are people can get a test. It is according to a priority structure, and it's not enough testing. It's just as simple as that. We have been pleading with the federal government for weeks, publicly, letters, phone calls, get us testing so we can get ahead of this. Here's the reality. This is a war-like situation. We're in a wartime scenario with a Mar-a-Lago attitude being used by the federal government, right? It's so laid back, and I don't understand it. And by the way, testing? How about ventilators? Where is the federal government making sure that our hospitals have the ventilators we're going to need? Where is the federal government when it comes to surgical masks, getting them distributed where they need? This is a case for a nationalization, literally a nationalization of crucial factories and industries that could produce the medical supplies to prepare this country for what we need. A hand sanitizer. People are going crazy. I don't blame them trying to get hand sanitizer.
Is it true that we're having hand sanitizer now made in New York?
The state has found a way to make it, and that's great. But the point I'm saying is the federal government should recognize this is literally a crucial part of stopping this.
Yeah.
There should be a national approach to ensuring every factory that can make hand sanitizer should be on a 24/7 shifts, and the distribution should go to the places that need it most.
Yeah.
But we're not even in the discussion now because we can't even get the testing on
exactly.
Top.
And people
it's
are being,
backwards.
They're being left to their own devices to run out and stock up on toilet paper, which is irrelevant.
Stuff. I mean, there's a couple things at play here. The first is when it comes to like personal protective equipment, the things that we're running short of, a pretty quick analysis shows that there are plenty of private sector organizations who have long been waiting, as well as on the testing side, to fill this void. They just couldn't do it or can't do it yet because the FDA approval process or the CDC approval process will take 45 plus days. So it's not because there is a lack of willingness or lack of interest. It's just because the regulations are so strict and so rigid that
and the what he is saying, and this is New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, a failed Democratic presidential candidate. his approach is like, look, we want the federal government to take control of everything. They aren't doing enough. They need to step up.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, calling on the federal government to nationalize industry, one, is incredibly frightening. I just don't think that it's appropriate. I mean, my favorite response in regards to some of this craziness is actually from a Democratic governor of Colorado, Jared Polis, when he was asked about aspects of Trump's plan to nationalize certain things. And so, I mean, for those who aren't familiar with Jared Polis, he's the Democratic governor of Colorado. He was asked in regards to government bailouts and proposals to nationalize business, specifically what he thought of Trump's plan. And he said, no, I don't actually think this is a good idea because I'm not a socialist like Donald Trump. And I don't think that the government needs to be owning the means of production.
That was good.
it was great. Yeah. So kudos to him for continuing to carry the banner of the market Democrats. But yeah, it's definitely troubling to see how quickly people will turn to extraordinary means, despite the fact that there are some viable, simple solutions kind of just waiting in the whims.
Yeah, and there's so much innovation that is happening. You know, we're a few days into this, depending on where you are in the state, in the country, in the world, there's different jurisdictions that are now in certain levels. I know that in the state of Pennsylvania, the governor last week ordered a mandatory shutdown of basically all business except those deemed life-sustaining. And that is actually pretty crucial if you are in essentially any industry where you have a shop that's physical and you have people that are employed, because now all of these shops are mandated to be shut down. It is one of the strictest in the country that I've seen. I know California and Illinois and New York have had their own orders, but they've actually allowed a lot of other business to continue, things like construction sites, as long as people follow the guidelines from CDC. But Pennsylvania, and obviously they took the number one crime and they shut down all the liquor stores, which are government owned. So they,
brutal.
They're definitely on the list for a terrible way to approach this. And look, this is ongoing. I mean, I think we've covered this on the program now the last couple of months. I remember back in, I think when I was in Spain at one point, we were talking about coronavirus and communism when it was exclusively in China, and just, you know, seeing it all unfold and seeing what governments are doing. I think it's probably pertinent. Let's just talk about what some of the oversteps are. Assuming and knowing that there are many important things that the governments are doing, that it is important to practice social distancing, washing your hands, la, la, la. You've heard the commercials. I mean, this is every other YouTube ad now, by the way. If you don't have the Brave browser and you're not blocking ads on YouTube, every other thing is some company telling you to wash your hands. Couple of states and places where this is going a bit crazy. So definitely in European countries, they're having a lot of issues right now. There's an article from Politico that we'll put in the show notes. In fight against coronavirus, governments embrace surveillance. So there's a lot of Chinese-style surveillance that is now coming to many countries throughout the European Union. One is Poland. Now, if you had traveled from outside of Poland somehow in the last month and you're in the country, you now are required to download this special app where you are then proving to the government that you every few hours are at home. So you get a notification on your phone and you're required to take a selfie, a government mandated selfie, to ensure that you're staying at home. And there a lot of facial recognition companies are out there. They're definitely very, very busy. It's getting a bit crazy. David, are there any other that come to your mind in terms of, you know, overreach or overstepping? Again, we accept the premise that people need to be careful, and this is obviously an important time to control public health, but man, there's a lot of excess out there.
Yeah, I mean, the So this the same thing happened in Canada. Trudeau was the prime minister was asked, well, are you going to basically track people's cell phone data to ensure that they're staying at home and not going out? One, I don't really see that as being necessary in many of these instances. I mean, it's already prohibited to do those things, so
But
you could
it is
just.
happening in some places. I know in Germany it's happening. In Austria they asked to do it, but they don't have the legal authority. But in some other places, I think in the Netherlands and definitely in Singapore, they're tracking people's phone location to make sure that they're staying at home and they're not moving too much.
Yeah, so you should have to have a warrant to be able to do that. Just like any other burden where you're going to be tracked by the government or law enforcement, you should have to have some burden of proof to demonstrate that the person is deserving of that tracking.
But David, we're in an emergency situation. Don't you understand?
Of course, I think the thing is that there has to be a line in terms of the civil liberties that we do defend. I think it's totally appropriate in many instances for governments to actually engage in these lockdowns, and in many instances to close non-essential businesses. Some would argue that it wasn't soon enough. Some would argue that it's too heavy-handed. That's fine. I think that those are all well and good, but as soon as you then take it to that next level of warrantlessly surveilling citizens in violation of their constitutional rights, that is, I think, a bridge that we shouldn't cross.
Yeah.
And I think that there has to be other means, or there has to be legal means to do that. And so, I mean, so one solution would be, and I know that some jurisdictions have done this at airports, where essentially people are given notice when they arrive. Let's say they've flown in from somewhere, they've given notice when they arrive that they have to self-isolate for 14 days. And then, in theory, if they were caught out and about after that, they could be fined or whatever the penalties are. I think that that's a much more appropriate solution than tracking everybody's cell phone data and basically turning this into this Orwellian Big Brother system where they know where you are and when you're there and all of those things. That's incredibly concerning for me.
If you're interested in tracking this, you can use the hashtag COVID1984. I've been using that a lot, just trying to track this stuff because it is pretty crazy. I mean, not just the cell phones, it's also the rule of law. No surprise to anyone, Hungary, which is a fairly authoritarian state, now they just passed a decree whereby Orban and his government essentially can just rule without any kind of opposition and just do it by pen for the next 2 years. No questions asked. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that was a playbook that was in the drawer of the office of like the most sinister authoritarian dude ever and somehow gets like thrown onto the desk in a time of emergency. And that's dangerous. This is the worst time for this kind of stuff to come to the fore because everybody's panicked. What do we do? What do we do? We don't know what to do. We have to go to the government. And you heard the Blasio approach. You know, if everybody was like the Blasio, I mean, goodness, we'd be getting our daily updates fed to our brains from Trump, and he'd be controlling our every move. I don't think anybody really wants that.
Well, and this is the way I look at it. We take these extraordinary measures so that one day we can return to normal. But we can only sacrifice so much because if we sacrifice too much, there won't be a normal to return to. That's an important
Yeah.
distinction that people need to understand is
And
that
we need
when
to
we
follow
give
the
up.
rules. Got to follow the rules.
I mean, this happened in Canada as well. Again, the Prime Minister. Essentially try to push through in their COVID-19 bill provisions that would give them the ability to tax and spend without parliamentary approval until midway through 2021,
Yeah.
which is ridiculous. One, it completely violates one of the core principles of parliamentary democracy. But two, it's just an incredible overreach in terms of attempting to say that the executive office can say, okay, well, we're going to do this and this in terms of taxes and spending and get no approval whatsoever for it. So it's, you're seeing instances like this where people who are otherwise not authoritarian or not, they're not Orban, using this as a means to creep into, or just add to what they're allowed to get away with, which is certainly problematic.
Speaking of creeps, I actually just grabbed this clip before we got onto the program here, David. This is about the $2 trillion bill that was just passed in the United States that will give $300 billion worth of direct aid. That is like a $1,200 payment, or depending on your level of income, to every American, and then also huge amounts of loans, some bailouts, some very low interest loans. And here's Nancy Pelosi, who was commenting on the bill and her karate moves to make sure that they could get their version of the bill passed.
Jiu-jitsu on it, that it went from a corporate first proposal that the Republicans put forth in the Senate to a workers first, Democratic workers first legislation. But let's first back up. As I was coming here, I saw that nearly 1,000 deaths in the United States, 900 yesterday, so I don't know what the number is today, but they're saying nearly 1,000 deaths in our country. Tens of thousands of people we have tens of thousands of cases. This is a pandemic that we haven't even seen since for over 100 years in our country. It's really such a tragedy.
Okay, we don't need that, but you're listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM. Huge bill that was passed. I think it'll take us a couple shows to deconstruct everything that was in there.
Of course.
Goodness me.
Well, and you start to very quickly realize some crazy things that are in there. Like, why is the Kennedy Center getting money in the bailout?
Oh, you know, Trump defended that, by the way.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
He went out and said, you know, I'd love to go. I'd love to just waltz on down there and walk in and see the stuff they have there. Do you even know
what
it is?
But it's ridiculous. I think that actually Justin Amash, the congressman from Michigan, basically said it best. He said we should just be providing immediate cash relief for citizens to help get them through the bills that they have to pay, but we shouldn't be doing it in the form of corporate welfare. I mean, I think the numbers are, for $2 trillion, you could give every family $7,000 per month for 3 months.
Yeah.
And that would allow for families basically to pay things like mortgages, to cover rent, to cover food, to continue to make the payments on things that are health insurance payments, car insurance payments, basically to keep life proceeding with some resemblance of normalcy without this convoluted back and forth of, which is what's going on now, between progressives who want to use the bailout to basically completely restructure the economy in corporate America, and on the Republican side, who want this to filter down through some of the largest corporations and some of the most profitable corporations in the world. And so it was interesting to see Congressman Amash have like it's essentially a middle third way of providing relief that that doesn't come with sacrificing really what are huge cash transfers to companies.
Oh, yeah.
Or on the flip side, completely restructuring the economy based on some progressive dream of what equality looks like.
Yeah, and this is all future tax increases there, ladies and gentlemen, so get ready for that. I'd like to open a new segment, if that's okay with you, David.
Yep.
Because you'd be in jail.
So this is the criminals criminal section of the Consumer Choice Radio Show. Couple of people I wanted to highlight. Despicable behavior. Those of you listening in North Carolina, right now we have a senator who is a crook. You know, this is alleged crook. This is exactly what happened. He committed insider trading. We're talking about Senator Richard Burr, one of the senators in our state of North Carolina. So the story came out. The article that I have is from Matt Taibbi, one of my favorite reporters from Rolling Stone. This was, I guess, 2 weeks ago or a week ago. He basically now, Richard Burr is one of the most detested people and politicians in the country. So, yeah, I guess for compliance, he's not technically a crook. All right, whatever. But he received a highly confidential briefing on exactly what was happening with the coronavirus and the impact and the number of people and then the knowledge of the shutdowns. That same day, he went out, flipped open his phone, called his broker, and sold hundreds of thousands, if not millions worth of stocks after this, and then immediately goes into a briefing and says everything is rosy, everything is fine, no reason to be concerned, everything's going to stay open. I mean, this is just total hypocritic. I mean, this kind of behavior, the hypocrite that is Senator Richard Burr, and I'm sorry to be so strident, I'm sorry to be so forceful, but it's just true. You cannot, on the one hand, get this information and go and sell and enrich yourself, and at the same time turn around and say everything is fine, no reason to worry. All those other people, by the way, you know, they probably sold off a lot of stock because they were panicked and they lost a lot of money, a lot of their net worth, a lot of their retirements because of the stuff that you said last week, and now these people are screwed. So I think that's total crook-like behavior. I'm trying to be compliant here. But total bad guy move, Richard Burr. Vote him out or get him out. There was a poll done that majority of people in North Carolina want him to resign. We got to follow up on that.
I mean, if his money isn't in a blind trust and he actively has any conversation with his portfolio manager or investment advisor, you got to go. That is just... I mean, it's one thing to take the insider knowledge and act on it. It's another thing to take the insider knowledge, tell the American people the complete opposite, and then act on that insider knowledge. So,
and the reason this is an issue, by the way, is because insider trading by members of Congress, there were actually no laws against this early on. It's only because of a book by Peter Schweitzer. I think it's called Throw the Bums Out. That featured this and said that essentially you are able to insider trade if you're a member of Congress. You can trade on that private information, non-public, and you know, people have been doing this for years. I mean, why do you think all these politicians are multimillionaires by the time they leave, even though they've never had any job but being in the government? This is fairly concerning. I think the studies that were done after this ban on insider trading passed showed that if you actually wanted to see what particular members of Congress were doing, you actually needed to go into a library that's located in Congress. You're not allowed to take any documents out. You're not allowed to take any pictures. And it's just like essentially a huge list of trades that members of Congress have made. So I don't know who tracked this down and who figured it out, but great reporting on this because this is sleazebag behavior.
Oh, it's horrific. And I also, like, who in their right mind doesn't hold, like, senior public office like that and not completely be hands-off with their own portfolio?
Yeah.
Like, how, like, surely even the concept of managing your own money is a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Because you... are one of the are one of the X amount of people who can influence the outcome of your own investments in a really coercive way, whether it's wanting to overregulate one industry to benefit another, or selling at the right time, or anything along those lines. I mean, it seems bizarre to me. Like I remember seeing the headline come through and tweeting like, "Wait a second, they don't have their money in blind trust." Like I know that this is what Mitt Romney did when he was running for president. He said, well, I'm just going to pass off all my investments and not be able to view them while I'm president, and they're going to be handled by someone external to me, and I won't have any information. That sounds like a much more appropriate way to go about. I mean, obviously, they should be able to invest. They should be able to grow their money. That's not a problem. It's just whether or not they should be able to manipulate it in that way.
Oh yeah,
which is so, so corrupt.
And we're only highlighting Richard Burr because he has, I mean, he's someone who holds very reprehensive views to consumer advocates, to lovers of liberty. He's the number one cheerleader for the U.S. surveillance state, hugely in favor of torture. I mean, he's head of the Intelligence Committee there in the U.S. Senate, so he's privy to a lot of information. And we're only picking on him, as I mentioned, but there's plenty of others that did this. Kelly Loeffler, David Perdue of Virginia, James Inhofe of Oklahoma, and Dianne Feinstein of California. She actually sold off even more. I think it was like tens of millions of dollars. Her husband is some kind of traitor as well. But for Richard Burr, it's more that he turned around and said everything's dandy and fine and beautiful. And he even wrote a couple of op-eds, David, in which he said that, like, days after this hearing. So, yeah.
Because you'd be in jail.
That's for Senator Burr.
Yes, exactly. And real quick, how did Feinstein dodge most of the negative PR?
I'm not sure. Because it's happened to her before. Because she is immensely wealthy, like hundreds of millions of dollars that her and her husband are worth. And she's been in government now for, I don't know, 30, 40 years, something like this. Maybe that it comes with that, or it just comes with being California immune. That could be it. Okay.
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get it. She, whoever she's paying to dodge that coverage is doing a very good job.
Yeah, and later in the program, you're listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM. Later in the program, we will be getting a little bit of insight on the coronavirus from someone who actually is a public health expert, not these two bozos on the radio. So we'll be speaking with William Pilkington, who is a research professor at the North Carolina Central University, used to be head of the public health department in Cabarrus County, North Carolina. So I've known him for a good number of years. He's got a great interview, so we'll play that here in a bit. But other clips that I wanted to get to, David, if we wanted to extend the crook section of the show, there is a lot, specifically with journalists. It's not crook-like behavior, but it's repugnant behavior. Great article from Spiked Online. If you're not following Spiked, you definitely should. This is from Fraser Myers. Why are so many journalists clamoring for a police state? So there's been, in the United Kingdom, the lockdown just happened. I think that went into effect earlier this week. And there, the media has been like chief number one in pressuring the government to get the police out, to shut down all the shops. And that's what this article is, you know, looking at, is the people from the Daily Mail and the BBC have been saying, oh, you know, we need to be locking people up. Why are they out and about? Why are they at the park? What are they doing? We need to be shutting everything down, which there's argument for, but there's another when you're lobbying the government to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely weird to see. I mean, authoritarian can often be a overused word, but I mean, when we're talking about full lockdowns, military on the street, arresting people for walking the dog. Like, I think that's probably fair to call it authoritarian.
You've been safe, though. You haven't gotten pestered from walking the dog?
No. So in Ontario, where I am, all non-essential businesses are closed. But, I mean, the list of non-essential businesses is like 70-plus businesses. So it's pretty loose. So it's everything from stores that sell pet food to mechanics to vets to basically anything that is important in the supply chain. So it's not a complete shutdown. And we don't have any actual formal laws yet requiring people to stay at home. Okay. And where I am, at least, people are, I mean, you see people to go out for a walk. There are no issues with that. But generally speaking, from what I've seen, it's been pretty good. You're not seeing, like in Florida, crowded beaches or anything like that.
People on spring break, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff that can cover. If you have any other links and you want to shoot them to us, you can always send us an email, hello@consumerchoiceradio.com. Very willing to hear your comments on that if you have additional examples. David, we do have a couple of example recovery plans when we're talking about what's going to happen to the economy. This one just came out, I think, on Tuesday. One group actually has a fix for how we can get the economy started again. So this is, what is the recovery?
We begin with up-to-the-minute financial fallout shelter coverage of today's top story. The nation's girlfriends continue to press for an economic recovery plan they say could save the nation as much as $220 billion annually if their boyfriends simply agree to move in with them. Prominent girlfriends from across the country testified before Congress earlier today.
Our plan could dramatically cut expenditures for more than 1.2 million American couples who basically live together anyway, if you look at how much time they spend with each other.
There has been some criticism that you're pushing America's boyfriends, that it's not time for this type of situation.
Congressman Ingersoll, this is not even about wanting to live together. Even though a lot of us have been together with our boyfriends from anywhere between a year and 3 years, and everyone who knows us says we're the perfect couple. In a recession, it just doesn't make any sense for two people who say they love each other to pay separate rents.
Joining us now live from Washington is a spokeswoman for the nation's girlfriends, Kelly Ambrose. Welcome, Kelly.
Hello, Andrea.
Now, you and the other girlfriends have been very vocal about this plan in the past few days. Why the sudden push?
Andrea, the slogan of our movement is, it's time. This plan just makes sense for us financially.
But some boyfriends have said there are other ways to save money, like not going out for expensive dinners and extraneous brunches, or not taking that trip to Vermont to see the leaves change.
Yes, but in our plan, we don't have to make cuts. In fact,
I see.
We could even use some of the money we save on sports things or whatever boyfriends want.
Okay, well, but isn't there...
Our plan will also encourage consumer spending, since having new apartments would spur an anticipated 45% increase in dinner parties, cocktail parties, maybe even a Halloween party with fun drinks that have Halloween-related names.
Now, some boyfriends have been dragging their feet on this
issue. That's right. Do the nation's boyfriends want to sit there just watching our national debt grow and grow while their stupid roommate Chad hangs out in the living room playing video games 24 hours a day?
Sure.
So the boyfriend can never watch a movie, even if his girlfriend brings over a DVD that she has rented.
Okay, well, we have a...
So there's one recovery plan. The get the boyfriends to, you know, move in with a girlfriend's plan.
Yeah, that was that's quite the clip. It's pretty funny. It's nice to see there's some comedy amidst all the chaos and hardship. There are plenty of really, really good meme campaigns and accounts on Instagram as well that are kind of echoing some of these funny comments,
and that was from the Onion
time.
Like a decade ago.
yeah.
So
what's funny is that for a lot of, there's some really good ones, and I'm sure some listeners who are now working remotely can sympathize. They're now working at home with for the first time while their spouse is also working from home, so the dynamics of having a spouse who is now a coworker in terms of your space can certainly make things interesting.
Oh, yeah, it's making it a bit tough. And speaking of people in need, David, we need to go to your buddy, someone that we've spoken about a lot on this program, as someone who is the next candidate maybe to be president of the United States, your buddy Joe Biden. Let's go and check in on old Uncle Joe.
We have to take care of the cure. That will make the problem worse no matter what.
Sorry. All right, this ain't done. This ain't done. We got a whole minute of this.
And what is it like to be a candidate in the time of social distancing?
Well, I'm doing fine, thank you. And I think we've been
public, but first of all, in this crisis, spoke earlier. He's talking.
And I tell you what, I'm so darn proud. And those poor people who have lost, you know, anyway. It's just, my heart goes out to
them. No. Listen, we have to make a choice about who leads this country.
I just can't figure the guy. It's like, it's like watching a yo-yo. I shouldn't have said it that way. It's like watching.
It feels that way. I want to ask. I want to. It's okay. About
awkward laugh.
The reporting in the New York Floyd to Home Alone with children.
Why doesn't he just act like a president? That's a stupid way to say it.
You know,
I guess,
Donald Trump
really
was asked.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, probably best I don't.
And this is just part one. Let's go to part two.
I've not talked to any individual. Excuse me.
You know, you're supposed to cough into your elbow. I don't know, sir. I learned that actually covering your White House.
That's true, but fortunately I'm alone in my home, but that's okay.
All right. I agree. You're right.
You should just, it's kind of old school to do it with your hand. Do it into your elbow. You're supposed to do it.
It's a strange world.
Let me.
What an absolutely insane thing to say to someone calling from their house. Like, he's in self-isolation. He can cough however he wants.
Yeah, but you're setting an example as someone who's supposed to run the country, and you're sitting there coughing in your own head. He's a hand cougher.
Oh, it drives me. Yeah, I understand that, but that just drives me nuts. Leave Uncle Joe alone. He's doing his best. Okay?
Leave him alone. Right, right, right. Well, I'm sorry there, Joe Biden, but, you know, when you enter the candidacy.
Welcome to Thunderdome.
Yeah. Exactly. Welcome to Thunderdome. Here we go.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not all politicians here that are struggling and, you know, not able to follow advice. There's some good advice that is being put out there by particular politicians, one of which is the premier of Quebec, François Legault. And here he is talking about alcohol amidst the COVID crisis.
I don't want to see any chaos in groceries to get some alcohol if we close the SAQ. Second, I think some people, unfortunately, they need to have some alcohol, so I don't want to bring those people in the healthcare network. And I think that also for the to reduce the stress, you have to do some exercise, so have a walk, but sometime a glass of wine may help.
Glass of wine might help.
And so I've been fairly critical of him in the past, but I will say I love the fact that he basically said, I'm not going to shut down the liquor stores because people are stressed out and maybe they're going to want to drink.
Yeah.
I love the fact that he's just like, you know what? Some people like a glass of wine.
This is the French-Canadian model of government, at least when it comes to drinking. So we do very much appreciate that. And yeah, that's our nature. So that was François Legault over in Quebec, who is north of the border. I've got a couple other clips here, David, but let's go ahead and we want to cue up this interview that we did with William Pilkington talking to us about the local response to coronavirus. I think it's very important in the state of North Carolina where this is being broadcast on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM. We thought we'd give you a little bit of insight as to the local approach to what's happening. So go ahead, Jamie, cue the clip. Welcome back to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM. We're speaking with William Pilkington, who is a research professor at the North Carolina Central University, and he's a former health director of the Cabarrus Health Alliance in Cabarrus County, North Carolina, for 38 years. Mr. Pilkington, hello. Thank you so much for being on the phone.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to get you on because you are uniquely positioned to understand a lot of the stuff that's happening. Everyone is following the international and national headlines, but I figured it'd be great to have more of a North Carolina state perspective. You're someone who understands public health generally very, very well. It's been your career for many years. You've built up an expertise. What are some insights that you can give us about North Carolina, coronavirus? You know, are there enough adequate steps being taken? Are there things that we should be focusing on more? What are your general thoughts right now?
General thoughts are we're working in the United States all over, as well as in every community, on trying to reduce the communication of the virus between cities, within cities, increasing testing, and increasing our contact tracing as well. So those are the kinds of things that are going on, which are the right steps to be taking. A little bit of concern in that we're far behind most other countries in testing. And we need to step up the testing because that's where you're able to do the analysis of how many people are contracting the disease and how widespread it is.
And usually when, you know, there would be some kind of disease that would be out there and we needed to do testing, how would that normally work? Would it come from a centralized entity such as the CDC? Would it come from, let's say, state health departments, county health departments? How would that usually work if you needed to get some kind of testing out for things like the flu or other viruses?
In this case, it's a variety of entities that are doing it. Hospitals are involved in it because they have more access to the testing kits at this time. County health departments are involved in it, and there's even private entities and private. I read last week where a general practitioner in London made quite a fortune, over one million pounds selling testing kits. So there's a lot of people involved in this at this point in time. And until we get a ample number of publicly supplied kits, it's going to continue to be that way.
And when it comes to comparing this to the past, obviously we've never seen this scale of measures taken before. You know, are there any similar things that you've had to deal with in your job in North Carolina that maybe is close to the same level, or is this really unprecedented?
Well, nationally, this is unprecedented. Here in the county that I worked in, Cabarrus County, we had to put in place a quarantine for measles back in the late 1980s. And that was quite a similar situation to now, in that we limited the flow and movement of people, what they could do and what they couldn't do, because measles, interestingly enough, is even more communicable than this coronavirus. So it was very important that we shut down all kinds of activities, school activities, community activities, and other activities. And it worked. Within a period of about 3 weeks, we were able to take care of that situation. So it's not unprecedented for me to deal with. It's probably unprecedented for most of my colleagues throughout the nation to deal with, because most of them have never dealt with quarantines or isolations in a wide community spread nature.
And we've heard about experiments, or they were thinking about taking this herd immunity approach in places like the UK and the Netherlands. Eventually they abandoned that. Is that something that public health experts have been talking about as one way that could have solved this early on? Or was this something that, due to the scale and the fatality, was just never really in the cards?
Well, the herd immunity would have had to have worked with the vaccine, and we have no vaccine for this. So without a vaccine out there, you couldn't build herd immunity, which is what you commonly do with some of the basic childhood diseases that we vaccinate for. That's what we're hoping to do. As we know that this will probably be something that's with us for several years. So how do we deal with it next winter and the next winter? And the thinking is that by hopefully next year, we will have a vaccine that will address that.
Wow. Okay. And considering that you've been on the front lines of public health for many years, dealing with, as you mentioned, things like measles and obviously any kind of local health outbreaks that might have happened, you know, are you seeing in where you're working now, in your more in academia and I guess more in line with the public health authorities there, are you seeing that there's a lot of conversation? Is there anything positive that we can look forward to, not just in terms of in containment, but maybe in terms of innovation and where we are seeing a lot of progress or really things to be hopeful about?
I'm not sure it's a, you asked for a positive. I'm not sure it's a positive. What we're seeing from the academic standpoint is the problem with health inequality and the fact that we don't have a national healthcare system here like some of the European countries that are dealing with this. So about 30% of our population do not have access to healthcare services. For that reason, this a pandemic like this is much more of a concern. And working toward the positive, what we need to do is figure out how in situations like this we can get healthcare coverage to people that are needing it and don't have access to it, and keep them from getting very ill in these kinds of pandemic situations.
And there's been a lot of debates in Raleigh and in the State House about expanding Medicaid, and obviously nationally we're talking about Medicare for All and these kind of things. For North Carolina, is an expansion of Medicaid, is that something that could better address that inequality, or what could be some steps that we could take practically when it comes to policy, maybe not to make sure everything is correct now, but maybe to prepare us for the next pandemic?
That would be one of the very first steps, as we're one of 13 states out of all the 50 that have not expanded Medicaid. It's purely for political reasons, and we need to do it. It would cost 90% of the cost is paid by the federal government. Only 10% of the cost belongs to the state. It would be a wonderful way to say to the children, especially of North Carolina, we value your health and we're going to take care of your health needs.
Sure. And for your current position, what has been that sort of transition? I mean, you were in charge of public health in an entire county, and now more focused on, I guess, educating and more in academia. How has that transition been for you?
Well, most of my job currently is working with health inequality and racial disparities in healthcare. So what I'm looking at is throughout this nation's history, at no time have Black Americans had equal to or the same life expectancy as white Americans. That's a travesty. It's left over from our days of slavery. But we really need to start taking steps to make that happen. So my primary role through the HOPE program I work for at North Carolina Central is to try to look at options and interventions that will start to address these racial disparities in healthcare and why they exist.
Okay, great. And we've been speaking with William Pilkington, who is over at North Carolina Central University as a research professor, who is formerly the health director of the Cabarrus Health Alliance in Cabarrus County. William, thanks so much for your time. And thank you, William. Have a great day.
Well, now you heard another side to the story, but you want to know how it ends. If you must know the truth about the tale, go and ask the milkman.
And we're back on the Consumer Choice Radio here on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM. We just had an interview there with William Pilkington, who is research professor at North Carolina Central University. He brings good knowledge from the local public health community, having been the director over there in Cabarrus County, my home county. So great insight there. David, you've got you had a good number of hot takes over the week. You had some pretty awesome stuff that was flying over my console. Anything that has been hitting you in the news that you are either excited about or optimistic about? I mean, we're here on the radio, given we want to give people a couple of laughs, some information, and hopefully a little bit of inspiration, right?
Yes, yes. So actually, in Ontario on Thursday, the province announced that restaurants could start to deliver alcohol with food. And so if you are doing curbside or delivery from a restaurant, you can get beer or wine or anything basically that's sealed. And yeah, that's a huge change for Ontario, because Ontario, like many North American jurisdictions, has very Orwellian alcohol laws.
So if you were ordering your weekly Domino's or Papa John's, yeah. Are you more a Domino's guy, actually?
I'm a Domino's guy.
So
yeah.
When you're ordering your
Domino's
weekly...
We'll have to debate that on another show, but that is a hill I will proudly plant my flag. I'm definitely a Domino's guy.
If I had access to Papa John's, I'd probably favor it. I just don't have access. But so when you were ordering your weekly Domino's, you can't just add a couple drinks to the cart to have that delivered? No, beer? Really?
I mean, the issue here is that pizza chains aren't traditionally licensed. So you couldn't do it from Domino's right now unless they got their license. But what you could do is basically any kind of mainstay restaurant that serves in-dining alcohol, they can now deliver.
Okay.
And they can now sell. So the outlets that sell can now sell as early as 7 a.m.
Yes,
it used
please.
To be 11. Yeah, it used to be 11. Then when Ford got into power, he changed it to 9. And now it's 7 a.m.
That's smart. So, we need that early in the morning. Well, it's good. Look, you're just opening the market. You have to imagine there are some people on night shifts. You know, not everybody has 9-to-5s, right?
Yep.
So.
Yeah, and the more fluid it is, the easier it is for people to do their shopping not in peak times. So really to encourage people not to to have kind of jammed grocery stores where people are too close together and then others are getting sick.
Yep, and we're, you know, many weeks in now for social distancing, so hope everybody is staying compliant. You can definitely listen to this program on your own and be socially distant. You can listen on Spotify and Overcast and in the Apple Podcast Store, so plenty for you guys to follow up on. If you want to listen to any other clips or see the articles that we talked about, those will be over on consumerchoiceradio.com. I've got a couple other clips here, David, that I wanted to play. We got a couple of Trump things. I don't know, is that necessary? Do you need to hear from Trump? I mean, I think he's on TV now every single day with his press conference. Do you need a little bit of Trump injection, some MAGA?
I mean, let's get one.
Okay, this is a clip that I actually don't think we played this last week, but let's go ahead and play this. I think it's important. It's something that really more last week, I think, made all the rounds on the internet and was a good amount of Chinese propaganda that was injected into the mainstream.
Okay, why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this?
A lot of people say it's racist. It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China. That's why. Comes from China. I want to be accurate. Yeah, please, John. Please. I have great love for all of the people from our country. But as you know, China tried to say at one point, maybe they stopped now, that it was caused by American soldiers. That can't happen. It's not going to happen. Not as long as I'm president. It comes from China. John, please.
Two questions.
China.
Yeah, I mean, I think the debate over what the name is very much just a distraction. And I think that it was the New York Times actually did do a very good expose on the Chinese propaganda machine, the Communist Party's basically propaganda apparatus and what they're doing on social media to push out disinformation about things like where coronavirus started, how the Chinese have handled it, all of these different things. So, I mean, I think that the argument over its name is silly. I do probably agree with the reporter in some senses that calling it the Chinese virus would most likely fuel uncomfortable relationships between Asian Americans and Chinese Americans and those who aren't. And that's certainly problematic. I mean, we see those after every crisis, whether it's Pearl Harbor or 9/11 or now coronavirus. It's definitely no, it is not an excuse to be cruel or bigoted towards people who had nothing to do with the virus spreading, had nothing to do with the Communist Party. I actually think what he should have done is called it something in regards to like made specific reference to the Communist Party, and then use that as a chance to highlight all of the insane things that they did.
The commie flu, maybe the commie flu.
Yeah, it could be the commie flu, or something. I don't know. I mean, really, he could. If someone's going to get a creative name right, it's going to be Donald Trump. So yeah. I would actually defer. This is one of the very few areas where I would defer to his expertise in terms of coming up with snarky names.
Yeah, there's a great article on what you're talking about that, and this is exactly what, if it is true, that a lot of the Russia propaganda machine was doing during the election is, look, you know that things are rife in American social life, in American social culture. There's a couple of ticking time bombs that you can easily throw in there to confuse everyone and distract everyone for a couple of days. And that's exactly what happened with this. There's an article here from FoxNews.com from Barnini Chakraborty. She's actually the opinion editor there. China uses American media to push coronavirus propaganda as the war of words continues. So the example that she's talking about is the foreign ministry spokesman, Zhao Lihan, who is he's very active on Twitter. Chinese citizens can't get on Twitter, but he can. And he's the one going out and saying that a lot of people might have had this years ago. It might have, you know, originated in the U.S. You heard Trump say, you know, they were talking about how it came from the U.S. military. So it's very important to keep that in mind, that there's a lot of propaganda out there, and it's obviously rife. I think it's just atrocious that a journalist would be there in the White House press corps and would be parroting the Chinese propaganda that came from that. I think that's just atrocious, irresponsible. I would have done the same thing as Trump, likely. China, I probably would have done that, but who knows? I'm not in that position.
Yeah.
But there's a lot out there, and we'll definitely be talking a lot more about that in the weeks to come. We got to have some, you know, some watchdogs on what's happening with the Chinese Communist Party. It doesn't end here.
No, exactly. And we're starting to see, I mean, you mentioned the Chinese Communist Party. We've also seen groups that have affiliations with the Kremlin in Russia start pushing out conspiracy theories that the Italian government let coronavirus loose to basically call off their elderly population. There's all sorts of weird, crazy stuff going on out there. So it's important that we try and sift through the nonsense and figure out how to actually combat this disinformation.
Yeah, and you know there are still a lot of people who are calling this out, thankfully, because we still do have a free press, thankfully. But you know, it's getting harder and harder to have these conversations online. I don't know if you saw this, David, but YouTube has now put in a global policy where they're going to limit all video quality around the world on its site. So everything that was HD will now be standard definition. It'll be SD. So everything that you guys put out in 1080p, we're going to like knock that down to 360. So we're all going to be watching crappy YouTube videos. And that might be why, hopefully our connection is okay, David, but it probably is choppy a bit because of that reason. And the European Union asked politely Netflix and some other organizations, would you guys mind turning down the speed of your internet here really quick? We really appreciate it. Yes, sir. And yes, sir.
What's been funny is the response on Twitter is apocalyptic. Understandably so. You picture someone who is in quarantine at home, and then they got to deal with the lag of Netflix or the constant buffering. Which I can only, that would just be infuriating.
I mean, it's buffering that is not even necessary because in all the places, you're not seeing a huge uptick of data consumption. Yeah, there's more people online, but they're not seeing outages. They're not seeing what they're predicting. So I don't know what that's about. It's just another example of why we do not need to have huge government regulation of the internet. It's why we repealed net neutrality in the United States, and we're thankful for that. That was something that was very positive of the last couple of years, but terrible situation. Good God. I hope this doesn't continue because then we could see internet speeds around the world go down, and not because there's a need, but because there's a demand from governmental institutions. I find that sad. This is the perfect time that we can actually use our internet connections. We can connect with our families. We can hold virtual happy hours and FaceTime dates and all the rest. And, you know, you might face deteriorating quality on your video because of a governmental order from the European Union. I don't see Trump doing that, thankfully, but man, very concerning. Yeah. There's a couple other articles here that I have linked that I wanted to get to as well. There's a great video with the Austrian chef Wolfgang Puck and the American chef Thomas Keller. We'll probably play that clip next week. They're warning about restaurants because American restaurants are now basically on the brink of collapse if all restaurants are, you know, ordained that they must be closed, ordered to be closed. And some, as you mentioned, David, are able to provide takeout, but, you know, most of these fine places aren't. And these places don't operate on huge, you know, margins and stuff. These are these are fly-by-day operations mostly, so that's pretty sad to see.
Yeah, exactly. I think the big thing here is, like, these are not particular, like, the margins are small. The failure rate on restaurants is, I think, something like 60%. So they're a particularly vulnerable industry, and not everyone can transition to takeout. And even those who can, a lot of people are just eating at home because they don't want to have any additional exposure or risk. It's tough times for folks in the restaurant industry. Hopefully the sooner we can get through this, the better, and they can make their way on recovery.
Exactly, David. We're going to get back to the recovery, the road to recovery. I think it's going to be good. We've got trillion-dollar coins being minted in our name, so all is good here. You've been listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM. You can go to our website, consumerchoiceradio.com. Subscribe to the podcast. Follow along. We put everything out on YouTube as well, so we make sure that you can hear us and get your program delivered to you however you want. David, sir, it's been a pleasure to be on.
Yep, you as well. Talk to you next week.
We'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.